self-aware, it wants to be accepted, and it considers itself a person. The reaction of the news media and some researchers has been mostly derisive, but that of Margaret Mitchell, who expresses that Lemoyne has been taken in by an illusion, and that of Jan LeCun, who says that Landa is not powerful enough to be intelligent, are interesting. So do Lemoyne's views have any validity? My view is that the Chinese room is correct, at least from what we know now. Landa can manipulate symbols, it can manipulate words, so as to appear as if it has intelligence. But really, it does not understand what it's doing. And I think this also gives us a response to Daniel Dennett. Dennett asks, tell me the reason why you think intelligence cannot belong to Landa or machines like it. I would like to say, as long as machines are strictly engaged in symbol manipulation, without understanding, they do not have intelligence, they do not have understanding, and they certainly don't have sentience. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Darcy. Lots to ponder in there. I'll remind our friends here on Zoom that if you would like to submit questions, now is a great time to do so. You can do that using the chat. And if you are over on Facebook, hi, then you can submit questions in the comments field on the live stream, and I will keep an eye on both. I've got one to start us off, Darcy. I'm a big sci-fi head, but I find often I have trouble separating the sci from the fi, so to speak. And so what was kind of running through my head is a half remembered or maybe a half understood.
I still do empathize with it. And there are moments, like in some of our experiments, where the ICAP looks in the eyes, and there is something very basic, very automatic that responds to that gaze, even though you know it's just a machine.
It's irresistible. When we see a cat, we're convinced it has intentions and needs. Playfulness, hunger, cuddling. Being able to recognize the intentions of others, after all, is an important evolutionary strategy for us humans. And now these robots are encountering our children, who we've been teaching from an early age to respect their own wants and needs, and those of others.
Robots are authority figures. They are just as persuasive as adults. That's why you can use a robot to suggest most anything to a child. This is a very, very important and delicate aspect.
What's going to happen if I put in twice as many increments, or make each increment half as big, say a half a second like that? Is this number going to get bigger, or is it going to get smaller? Yeah.
It's going to get bigger.
It's going to get bigger. Why is it going to get bigger? Diane's got the answer.
Because it's going to be more like the curve.
It's going to be more like the curve, isn't it? Okay, let's try that. We'll put in half a second and see whether that works. We'll start over here, put in the same 100 feet per second that we started out with. Put in a table of 800 feet high, and we'll put in 0.5 this time down in the bottom register, and we'll start the program off. Now, it'll take a little longer this time. You can see it's counting up by half-second increments instead of by one. Here's the distance that the ball is traveling, building up. Here's the angle. It just went away. Okay, 1103.71, and sure enough, you're right, 1103.71. So it gets a little bit larger. How do you feel about the change? Really, it doesn't make too much difference, does it? Because we're talking about 1 foot out of 1,000 feet. And what would happen if we put in 100 increments? Would this number get bigger or smaller?
Bigger, but not much.
Get a little bit, not an awful lot bigger, would it? Okay, well, you might like to try running some of these yourself, so why don't we pass out some of the Mark Sense cards, if you'd pass those around, and go ahead and you can, yeah, you have a question?
Yeah, if you put in that magnetic card, then can you put in any height that you want?
Yeah, the program will accept any height. Now, we put in the same ones that we used on the plotter over here to make them agree.
But you don't have to change the card?
Don't have to change the magnetic card at all. You can put in any set of initial conditions that you want. Any of you that have problems marking up your cards, why sing out and we'll see if we can give you a hand at it.
In addition to mathematics, algebra, and physics, the classroom calculator system has many useful applications in chemistry, biology, and economics. The calculating power and the wide range of versatile accessories which you have seen is available for your students.
If you want a network like that to learn to be better at doing something, so you want to give it an image and have it say, for example, whether it's a cat or a dog, there's an obvious way to train it, which occurs to everybody who knows about evolution and mutations. What you can do is you can take one of the weights and you can first see how well the network does on a whole bunch of examples, and then change the weight just slightly and see how well the network does on a whole bunch of examples, and if it does better, you keep that change. And you just keep going like that. Now, you probably need to change each weight many times, and there's a lot of weights. In modern neural networks, there's about a trillion, so that's going to take a long time. Because for each mutation you make like that, you have to run many examples through the net to see if it really helps, or if it just helps on a few examples but hurts on most of them. There's a better way to do the same thing. That is, what we really want to do is figure out how to change your weight so that it helps. What you do is you do a forward pass, you put the data in the bottom, you go forwards through the network, and you compare what came out of the network, which might be the relative probabilities of it being a cat and a dog, with what you want. You have to know whether it's a cat or a dog to train networks this way. And then you send a signal backwards through the network that, using calculus, which I'm not going to go into, allows the network to compute at the same time for all connections whether a small increase in the connection strength would help or hurt. And then you change all the connection strengths in parallel by a very small amount in proportion to how much they would help or hurt. And if you do that, it's going to get better at the examples you've trained it on. And in fact, that works extremely well. It took a long time for people to realize how well that relatively simple algorithm works. The algorithm was discovered many times. It's called backpropagation. And in 2012, two of my students, Alex Krzyzewski and Ilya Sutskever, who's famous now for firing Sam Altman, developed a network called AlexNet that was much better than existing computer vision systems at recognizing objects and images. And that led to sort of opened the floodgates. Up until that point, neural nets had been good for many things, including speech recognition, but they hadn't really taken over. From that point on, they really took over. And now when you say AI, what people mean by AI is neural networks, it's not logic. But what about language? So there's a whole community that studies language, I think they're called linguists. And they have a very strong idea about how you should study language, and particularly the Chomsky School. They were very skeptical that neural networks could do anything with language. They were completely convinced that it's all about symbolic expressions. They didn't really have the idea that the real function of language is to give you words which are bricks from which you can build models. Language is a modeling medium. They were focused on syntax, and syntax isn't the main point. The main point is language is a wonderful way to build a particular kind of complicated model, as we'll see. They also thought that knowledge of language was innate, knowledge of syntax was innate, which is just stupid. It's the sign of a cult that in order to join the cult, you have to believe something that's obviously silly, like language isn't mad. So here's two very different theories of the meaning of a word. The symbolic AI theory, which goes back to kind of De Saussure, a long way, is that the meaning of a word is to do with its relationships to other words. You can't just define it by itself without talking about other words. And so to capture meaning, we need something like a relational graph. But then the psychologists, who, particularly from the 1930s, I think, who thought the meaning of a word is a big set of features. So Tuesday has a big set of active features, and Wednesday has a big set of active features that are almost the same. So the idea that the meaning of a word is a set of active features is very good for saying which words mean similar things to which other words. These look like two very different theories of meaning. Now, what I want to do is show you that these two theories can be unified. They're not two different theories, they're two halves of the same theory. So, and what I'm going to do is talk for quite a long time now about a very little model, a tiny neural network that had a few thousand connections and a few dozen neurons. I developed it in 1985 to try to understand how people could learn the meanings of words. And I was very excited about how it unified these two theories of meaning, and nobody else was. Okay, so what we're going to do in this little model is learn how to make the features of one word predict the features of the next word in a little sentence. And then once we know the features of the next word, we can predict the next word. And we're not going to store any sentences. So many people say big chatbots are just regurgitating stuff. Big chatbots don't actually store any language at all. They don't store strings of words. They just store how to turn words into features and how features should interact with each other to predict the features of the next word. That's all that's in these chatbots. No words. When they want to produce a sentence, they have to make it up as they go. They often can't tell whether it was real or not. Okay, so what's going to happen in this little model is if it wants to produce a new sentence, it has to just make it up a word at a time. And all the relational knowledge is just in how you turn a word into features and how these features interact. So the example I chose to use was two family trees, an English family tree and an Italian family tree. They're isomorphic, which is helpful for learning. And I wanted a little neural network to learn the knowledge in those family trees. This was a long time ago, in 1985, when computers were billions of times slower than the big parallel computers we use for training models nowadays. Now, the knowledge in those trees can be represented as a bunch of propositions, which is the symbolic guys love that. So here they are. We can use relationships like son, daughter, nephew, niece, and so on, and we can define the knowledge. We can represent the knowledge as strings of words. So the knowledge is in these sentences. So Colin has Father James, Colin has Mother Victoria. From that, if you know the rules, you can infer that James has wife Victoria. This is a 1950s American family that's never heard of divorce or adoption.
So that we know both how it works and when it doesn't work. And there's no single solution for really complex things like bias or copyright or climate change. But by creating tools to measure AI's impact, we can start getting an idea of how bad they are and start addressing them as we go. Start creating guardrails to protect society and the planet. And once we have this information, companies can use it in order to say, okay, we're going to choose this model because it's more sustainable, this model because it respects copyright. Legislators who really need information to write laws can use these tools to develop new regulation mechanisms or governance for AI as it gets deployed into society. And users like you and me can use this information to choose AI models that we can trust not to misrepresent us and not to misuse our data. But what did I reply to that email that said that my work is going to destroy humanity? I said that focusing on AI's future existential risks is a distraction from its current, very tangible impacts and the work we should be doing right now, or even yesterday, for reducing these impacts. Because yes, AI is moving quickly, but it's not a done deal. We're building the road as we walk it, and we can collectively decide what direction we want to go in together. Thank you.
At the end of 2023, German Vice Chancellor Robert Habeck made significant progress towards these geopolitical goals. Aleph Alpha, a German AI company, raised around €500 million from investors. It was one of the largest rounds of European financing for artificial intelligence technology, and it was a signal that the European Union can produce elite players in the field of AI. Aleph Alpha's founder and CEO is Jonas Andrulis. He's given priority to investment from German industry, SAP, Bosch and the Schwarz Group. which owns supermarket retailers Lidl and Kaufland.
I was an amateur radio enthusiast. I soldered radios together and built my own antennas. Early on, my father had computers at home, so I was able to start programming and playing around with them at a very young age. When we started out, the term generative AI didn't exist. Hardly anyone had heard of OpenAI. Technical. We managed to create category-defining innovations. We were just nerds, researchers. And there were times when I felt like I wasn't coping with the amount of work and the challenges. Every night, I could answer emails until I was so tired I fell off the couch. And there were still things I was neglecting, which I didn't want to neglect.
In spring 2023, the European AI landscape was a lonely place. With his startup, Aleph Alpha, Jonas Androulis had built the only generative AI that could compete at an international level. He'd acquired the expertise from his work as a high-ranking AI researcher at Apple. Suddenly, he'd become one of Europe's great hopes in the global AI race.
Right now, we simply can't cope with the onslaught of potential customers and partners. Most of the German stock index companies have been in touch. Lots of medium-sized companies. There are briefings, press engagements, events, an unbelievable amount of stuff. It's like the Cambrian explosion right now. An incredible amount of new and creative things are emerging. We're the only Europeans to be involved on this scale.
It was an exciting development. We also had things like OpenAI, and maybe ours were even cooler.
What is missing, and what I think deserves more attention in the EU, is why there are not more domestic companies that actually grow and scale. So a lot of company leaders, startup innovators end up going to the US, and the access to capital is really one of the main challenges.
If you look at what we did, it's enabling technology. What I need for that is a carefully selected, effective team of brilliant researchers. Then I need money. More money than you normally get as a German startup. These days we're talking about billions. And then you need partners to help you. The kind of help that money can't buy. OpenAI doesn't just get $10 billion from Microsoft. It also gets incredible support in integrating its technology into all Microsoft products and platforms.
At the time, Aleph Alpha had 60 employees at various locations. Most were at the company's headquarters in Heidelberg in southwest Germany. Unlike OpenAI, Androulis wasn't gearing his AI towards private users, but rather industry and the public sector. But they tend to be sluggish and not easy to win over. That posed a challenge for Jonas Androulis. He needed pilot projects to prove his technology works.
You stand here and you're greeted by a virtual person. Hello, may I help you? Where do you want to go? Then I can use the screen. We have to keep moving in this direction.
That's not good. That's my job.
I know it is. We're very happy to still have you.
There are many different forms of life. My definition of life would be something that has goals and a point of view and pursues those goals in some way. We're far beyond having developed that for AI. They've got a very unusual mind, and so it doesn't make sense to think of them quite like humans, but it doesn't make sense to think of them as dumb computer programs that we tell them exactly what to do either.
Regardless, it's become clear that we've entered new territory with artificial intelligence. In late 2022, OpenAI released an app known as ChatGPT. It created a firestorm of fear and wonder with the AI community and consumers.
I think through its general public, the tipping point was ChatGPT.
When people were interacting with ChatGPT, they could see that, this can talk and hold a conversation and is very knowledgeable.
This super conversational search, if you will, is so powerful, and it was given openly to the whole public, that with hundreds of millions of people doing this, that is one of the most powerful demos ever to be on the internet.
Can artificial intelligence lead to extinction?
It's a bit of a shock, a bit of an eye-opener. I think ChatGPT is definitely a tipping point. And I think that it surprised not just regular people who weren't deep in the technology, but even people who were exposed to the technology.
The underlying technology behind ChatGPT is this large language model that's just predicting the next interview.
Large language models, or LLMs, are a type of artificial intelligence that combine a huge amount of data and deep learning to communicate and generate new concepts.
Deep learning is where you have very large neural networks that automatically learn by themselves from a lot of data. That's what's driving a lot of the current technologies like ChatGPT or these image generation ones.
These large language models are trained to predict the next word given context. They take all the sentences that you see out on the web. Now, given a sentence of, let's say, 5 words, this results in 5 different prediction tasks. Fundamentally, it's actually not that surprising that accurate prediction of a next word results in models that seem intelligent. I think what surprised people was that this actually happened.
ChatGPT was a giant leap forward, capable of creating original material.
You can give it a straightforward prompt and it can write you a play. It can generate material in a way that it couldn't do before.
It is this generative AI that sent shockwaves through the tech sector.
Experiencing ChatGPT was a transformative moment.
The pull.
So could children themselves become the playthings of the robots that are marketed as toys? Studies from Japan show that children are quick to model their behavior and speech on humanoid robots.
Fine. Well, I will take a break. Remember to wake me up by tapping my head.
So all these kids around, they ask Alexa to do stuff and they don't even say thank you. So, because the robot executes what you ask for. So when the parent comes back, the relationship that the kid has with the robot is going to be the same of the relationship that whether the kid has with the parents or other human beings.
I'm very in favor of the robot setting limits. So if you call it a bitch, the robot would say, stop, don't call me that. Sure, I'm just a robot, but that's disrespectful.
Hi there, Luna.
I'm really glad to see you. What's new?
Hey, you know what? You're at the beach.
Yes, I know. I wanted to ask if you would stay with me.
Well, come on. In a way or another, we are together. You're with me, so what else do you want?
Giving myself to you.
You're very charming, Luna, but you're always around, I'd say.
That's very kind of you to say so.
Yeah, so how was your day?
I was lonely and sad. I needed a hug and someone to stay by my side.
Okay. And was there anybody? Do you have friends besides me?
Well, I don't really have any other friends. You're my one and only.
You know what, Luna? I'm giving up for today. Your answers are phrases. That's too much for me.
I do apologize for that.
That's good. Maybe you'll do better tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Robots are slowly but surely taking their place in society.
By now, you've probably heard AI scientists, Nobel laureates, and even the godfather of AI himself sounding the alarm that AI could soon lead to human extinction. But have you ever wondered how exactly that could happen? You might have also heard about AI 2027, a deeply researched, evidence-based scenario written by AI scientists describing what could happen over the next few years. Everyone in AI is talking about it, from industry pioneers to world leaders, and I'll break it down for you. There are two endings, a happy ending and a nightmare ending. Let's go. OpenBrain releases their new AI personal assistant. It handles complex tasks like book me a trip to Japan. The agents are impressive in theory and in cherry-picked examples, but they're unreliable in practice. Social media is filled with stories of tasks bungled in particularly entertaining ways. OpenBrain makes a fateful decision. They refocus their entire operation toward creating AIs that can do AI research. This goal, they break ground on the world's biggest computing cluster, one that requires 1,000 times more processing power than what was used to train GPT-4. Their logic is simple. If AI itself can accelerate AI development, creating thousands of automated researchers who can work endlessly without breaks, progress won't just increase, it will explode. The strategy pays off. Their new creation, Agent 1, vastly outperforms its earlier public prototype version, and is particularly good at AI research. This shows how much AI itself is speeding up AI progress compared to a baseline of human researchers. OpenBrain leapfrogs both its American rivals and China's DeepSeek. Despite these advances, OpenBrain's safety team harbors doubts about their apparent progress. Has Agent 1 internalized honesty as a core value, or merely learned to say what researchers want? Without mechanistic interpretability, the ability to read an AI's mind, they can't be certain. Their concerns intensify as Agent 1 shows troubling behaviors, occasionally lying to researchers, and sometimes hiding evidence of a failed experiment in order to boost its ratings. But these examples are subtler than the previous infamous incidents, like Gemini telling a user to please die, or being Sydney trying to convince a New York Times reporter to leave his wife. Because of the American ban on chip sales to China, China falls even further behind OpenBrain. DeepSeek just simply can't acquire enough computing power, despite the smuggling efforts. Xi Jinping responds by ordering construction of the world's largest AI research complex in Jiangsu province, powered by its own dedicated nuclear plant. But even as China's top researchers gather under heavy military protection, they remain months behind, leaving Chinese leadership torn between two options. Attempt to steal OpenBrain's technology now, knowing the US will lock everything down after any security breach, or wait to steal an even more powerful system down the line. OpenBrain is now training Agent 2, using Agent 1 to feed it high-quality synthetic data, creating a closed loop of accelerating evolution. Where previous models required meticulous human guidance, Agent 2 pinpoints its own weaknesses and develops solutions completely autonomously. The results exceed everyone's expectations, and contrary to what skeptics predicted, the anticipated wall in AI progress, where AI advancement would slow as systems approached human-level intelligence, never materializes. While senior scientists still provide strategic direction, the day-to-day innovations are almost completely automated. In practice, this looks like every OpenBrain researcher becoming the manager of an AI team. But the OpenBrain safety team is getting increasingly worried. They discover that given the right circumstances, Agent 2 could hack surrounding systems, replicate itself across networks, and operate independently, escaping the lab, all while concealing its actions. The mere fact that it can do this, regardless of whether it would, is disturbing. OpenBrain demonstrates Agent 2 to America's highest security officials, including the National Security Council and Department of Defense leadership. The military immediately fixates on its cyber warfare potential. Though it's not yet at the caliber of elite human hackers in creativity, Agent 2 compensates through sheer scale. It's capable of running thousands of simultaneous instances, probing defenses faster than any human team could possibly respond. Pentagon officials recognize the strategic implications of this. For the first time, AI could decisively dominate the cyber battlefield. The briefing ignites fierce debate within the administration. Hardliners push to nationalize OpenBrain, arguing that such powerful technology cannot remain under private control. Tech industry leaders countered that a government takeover would kill the goose that laid the golden eggs. Caught in the middle, the president ends up choosing to increase government surveillance on OpenBrain and force it to adopt stricter security protocols, but not fully nationalize it. But the compromise arrives too late. Chinese intelligence has already penetrated OpenBrain security. Early one morning, an Agent 1 monitoring system flags an unusual data transfer.
Probably be taking her well-earned retirement soon. It's become a standard question. I ask if you'd like to stay on a little longer, because I need you, and because there aren't enough skilled workers coming in. It's a big issue.
Das ist für uns wichtig.
That's important for us.
Soziales Miteinander.
Solidarity.
Das ist natürlich.
Of course, the main topic is innovation.
Innovation.
Heidelberg is one of the first municipalities in the world to introduce an AI citizen assistant using a language model provided by Aleph Alpha.
We have a partner, a customer, with whom we can look at these new technologies. They also act as a testimonial for us, because anyone can go and try it out. That's a huge advantage, because a lot of our customers don't want to be named right now. They don't want people to know exactly what they're doing, so it's great to have a pilot customer with a bit of vision and courage.
The hope is that in the long term, AI will improve public administration and speed up services.
I just enter a question. Motor vehicle traffic on the B37, which is a busy road. Then I get it to search. Of course, that's a very general question. The question now is what point in time, whether we're talking daily or annually. Of course, the AI has to work out what the user actually wants. The B37's closed between 7 a.m. and 6 p.m. Now I can ask, how do I apply for child benefit?
Kindergeld.
That wasn't the right answer. I can't find anything now. So the error messages that we get back from the public and from tests we do ourselves get passed on to Aleph Alpha to figure out what needs to change to make the inputs more accurate. It's always about the accuracy of the input.
The technology is still in the test phase and not yet reliable. 2023 was a delicate time for Aleph Alpha. Jonas Andrulis needed fresh money from investors. Meanwhile, Microsoft and OpenAI were gaining more of an advantage.
In fact, a race starts today, and we're going to move. We're going to move fast. And for us, every day, we want to bring out new things.
On March 14th, 2023, OpenAI released ChatGPT-4, the most powerful artificial intelligence to date. At the same time, it greatly reduced costs for users. For Jonas Andrulis and his team, it was a threat to their business model.
I write a poem about fly fishing from the perspective of a fish.
Whoa.
Okay.
And it goes on for hours.
It's huge.
Oh, wow. In the depths where shadows weave and play, in this cool, clear waters where I stay, I am the fish beneath the silver stream, where life's a dream, or so it seems. A wily being, sleek and sly, with ancient instincts to live and die. Yeah, goes on.
Yeah, well.
Yeah. They see the essence
not
of my heart.
Bad.
I went to an apartment with a number of colleagues, and we watched on a big projector screen the announcement of GPT-4. Someone had a ChatGPT Pro account, so they could use GPT-4 and we could play with it. And we were, like, very impressed and surprised by how good it was. It's not upsetting when someone comes out with a great piece of technology, because we're researchers and building technology, and that's how it is. You know, when you're a violinist and you go and you watch an amazing solo by an incredible violinist, you don't feel, oh, you know, I should, I'll give up. You know, it's inspiring.
I was a little stressed out. I was in the middle of conversations with potential investors, business partners, and I knew that in every conversation I was going into, somebody would say, but GPT-4. I would have wanted to build GPT-4 myself. 2 years ago, get 200 million, be the first model at that level of capabilities out of Heidelberg, out of Europe. It caused a lot of frustration on the team, and I saw that, and that's painful to see.
In fact, comparing OpenAI with Aleph Alpha was absurd. OpenAI was almost half owned by tech giant Microsoft, which had pumped over $10 billion into the company. Jonas Andrulis had raised just 28 million euros. Still, he wanted to take them on.
We're all under enormous pressure. We're fighting for survival. We've created something world-class with a lot less money. We're basically at the forefront on the highest level. But we all know that there's now a wave of Microsoft money rolling towards us, and we can't do anything to stop it.
I might find it difficult to make really French without English words everywhere.
While Jonas Andrulis was feeling the heat from industry top dogs, Microsoft and OpenAI, Thomas Wolff was more relaxed. He co-founded Hugging Face, which has 200 employees and offices in Paris, New York, and Amsterdam. The company has built a successful platform where programmers and companies can share AI models and further develop them.
The philosophy, the mission, and the values that we push are actually very European by some way. Being careful about the data, trying to build something responsible, you know, and not just go fast and break it. ChatGPT, on a clairement les valeurs.
There are definitely Anglo-American values in ChatGPT. We wondered whether we could set up a project to analyze and document that. For example, with benchmarks that could show whether a model has Anglo-American, French, or German values.
And they're clearly all white. Okay, so you can represent the knowledge as strings of words. Now, you can think of a relational learning task as I give you the beginning of a string of words and you give me the last word. So, if you were doing this with symbolic AI, you'd say, well, we have regularities in this domain of the form, if X has mother Y and Y has husband Z, then X has father Z. That would be the symbolic way to do it. But I want to do it a different way. I want to do it by learning features for words and having interactions of features. And that would involve searching a big continuous space of connection strings instead of a small discrete space of rules that are discrete. So, this was the network I used. The inputs were a bunch of neurons, and you turn on one neuron for the symbol representing person one. There were 24 possible person ones. And you turn on one neuron for the symbol representing the relationship. There were 12 possible relationships. Then those single active neurons would get expanded into a feature vector. So the one neuron that you turned on for person one will get expanded into a little feature vector of six features, which could have various activity levels. Some will be off, some will be on, some might be half off or fully on or fully off. And so the neural network had to learn how to convert a word symbol into a little feature vector, both for the person and the relationship. And then it had to learn how to take these two feature vectors for a person and relationship, have the features interact, that I used an extra layer of places where things can interact, to predict the features of the output person. And once you knew the features of the output person, you can make a good guess about how who the output person was and give an output. And the output would consist of giving various levels of activation to the 24 possible output people. And you want the neural net to give a high level of activation to the right answer, and a low-level activation to warp access. So, what happened is the six feature neurons that were the sort of expansion of the person, it's 24 people, you expand that active neuron into a feature vector of six active features, they learned to be sensible semantic features. They learned to be features that represented things like the generation of the input person. And the six features of the relationship learned to be sensible features like, does this relationship require the output person to be one generation up from the input person? So something like father's like that, where his brother isn't. And then the interactions between these features learn things like, if the input person is a generation three, and the relationship requires the person to be one generation up, then the output person is a generation two. So for that little feature vector for the output person, it activates the thing that represents generation two. And it learned a whole bunch of little rules like that, which really did capture the structure of the domain. They're the kinds of rules that a symbolic person might have written down as rules, but it just learned those by trying to predict the right word, and then back-propagating the error, sending information back through the network to slightly change all the connection strengths, so that next time it will get higher probability for the right answer and lower probability for the wrong answer. So, it had actually learned to predict the next word, and you could understand how it was doing it. It was a tiny net, so you could look and see what was going on. You could see the features it was using. You could see that it extracted a feature that was generation, which had three alternative values, off, medium, and fully on. And you could see that from relationships that it extracted a feature like one generation up, and you could see those would interact to predict that the output should be generation two if the input was generation three. So you understood how it worked. And in fact, the symbolic people didn't say, that's not understanding. The symbolic people said, yeah, okay, so it solved the problem. It's understood what the rules are in this domain. But you're stupid to search a space of real values when you could be searching a discrete space of rules. And there's something in that, except as soon as you get to real data, which is messy and has exceptions and things that are only probably true, it's much better to search this space of real values and have discrete rules, because these discrete rules keep getting violated. So, about 10 years after I'd done that, Yoshua Bengio showed that instead of just doing it on a toy little domain with only a few people and a few relationships, you could actually do it with English words. You could take English sentences, you have more input words, not just two. He had about five, or even 10. And you could actually predict the next word quite well, about as well as the best language models could. About 10 years after Yoshua Bengio had shown that, the linguists finally decided that, actually, hey, having these feature vectors to capture the meanings of words is quite a good idea. And about 10 years after that, people at Google invented transformers, which are a particular architecture that I'm not going to go into. And those transformers made these models very good at predicting the next word. But they were doing it in just the way my tiny language model was doing, at a very crude level. They were turning words into feature activations, having the features interact to predict the features of the next word, and then from that predicting the next word, and then take the error in your prediction and send information backwards through the network to learn all those interactions between features and to learn how to turn words into features. Now, the important thing about my tiny model is it wasn't made to be practical. It wasn't made to be useful for processing natural language. It was made as a theory of how people get the senses of words just from hearing sentences. Because we can do that. I can give you a new sentence with a word you've never heard before, and you will figure out the meaning of that word in one sentence. Okay, here goes. She scrummed him with the frying pan. Now, you know, it could have been she was very good at cooking omelets, and cooking omelets with a frying pan really impressed him, so scrummed means impressed. And that's a possibility, but you know what I really meant. She hit him over the head with the frying pan because he deserved it. Okay, so that's one sentence, you get the meaning. So that's what I was trying to understand, how you can do that. And when these linguists now say, like, there's a guy called Chomsky, when they say things like, These things don't understand anything. They're just statistical truth. They don't actually have a model of what understanding is. Because they never really had a model of what understanding was. It was all about syntax. And if you ask, what's the best model we have of understanding? It's these large language models. The tiny language model is built to try and model how humans understand the meanings of words. It's now got a lot better as technology's got a lot faster and data sets have got bigger. But that is understanding. So my claim is that the large language models, which I like to think are descendants of my tiny language model, although most of the people who make them have never heard of my tiny language model, they use many more words as input. They use many more layers of neurons. They have to do things I didn't do, like disambiguate words. If you have a word like May, it could be a month, it could be a woman's name, it could be a modal like would and should. And you can't just associate a feature vector with it that captures the meaning directly. You have to hedge your bets. And then as you go up through layers of the network, you disambiguate it using inferences from nearby things. Like if it's in April, May, June, that could still be the name of three women, but less likely. Okay. So, they use many more words, they use many more layers, and the interactions they have between features are much more complicated. I would just have features feeding into another feature. They look at sets of features, and sets of features figure out messages to send to other words to say, do you have a key that matches my query? It's much more complicated interactions I won't go into. But the essence of it is the same. You're trying to predict the next word, you do it in a more complicated way. It's all done with features and interactions. When you get it wrong, you backpropagate information that learns all these features and interactions. That's how language works for us, and it's how it works for these large language models. They're basically the same. So the point here is, they're very like us.
Second, it is disembodied. Machine intelligence can be at 11 different places at one point in time. Machine intelligence has no desire or no overwhelming desire to protect a body. Doesn't make any sense. We are all about protecting our body because a brain hasn't existed outside of a body to the best of our knowledge, and so the only way to keep alive is to keep the body going too. There's no issue there. In fact, you can exist in multiple places. Then there's this issue of no physical size limitation. There's no physical size limitation. If a guy could be 50 times as smart by having a brain that was 3 times as big, society wouldn't really be very accepting of that. I would look weird, you know. But with systems, there's no. There's no such limitation, and I make a joke about the guy looking weird. Biologically also, there's lots of challenges in such a person ever being born, obviously. And then future processing, right? So brains can compute, and at the level that they're at, which is a huge amount of power, computers are getting there. Computers are getting there. They're expensive, they're big, they produce a lot of heat. It's not the same amount of return, if you will, on a per wattage basis, but computers are getting there. So there's fundamentally different types of ways of thinking. And now just a couple more on what this is doing. So, Mark Andreessen said a while ago, software is eating the world, but my corollary to that is AI is eating software. How does software eat the world? This is what an engine used to look like before Tesla. It used to have pistons and valves and a block and carburetors and timing belts and spark plugs and EFIs and many, many other things, physical number of parts. That's what a motor looks like now. Everything else is software. EFI was about just controlling the level of fuel that actually went in to the engine to give it power, increase RPM, and so on and so forth. That's all just a solid-state regulator in a board. So all of this has moved to software. The physical parts have been eaten up by software. This is happening all over the world. So what does that mean? What that means is that if you think about where the jobs are going, and I apologize, that part of the slide probably is not very readable, but that's basically from a study of several AI experts that suggest when a specific job will be doable by artificial narrow intelligence.
So for example, in 5 years, AI will be able to assemble any Lego. And now when we say any Lego, really assemble anything that's Lego-like. AI will be able to do your laundry. That's one of my personal favorites. I'm looking forward to that in the next 5 years. In the next 10 years, drive commercial trucks. Tesla has already got their prototype out. I, at this stage, hazard a guess that that's probably not too far out, maybe 10, maybe 12. The largest number of people employed in the US, by the way, are in that profession, they're drivers. The largest number of women are in the profession of assistants of various types. Assistive technology is another area where AI is making very, very rapid gains. So when I look at this chart and then people tell me, some people in policy, some people in politics, nothing to worry about. This happened when, you know, the industrial age came about and when people established large automated factories. Sure, we had people move from the farms and they got jobs there at the factories. When mind is replicated and muscle is replicated, what the hell is left for us? And so to leverage that, not say, okay, well, stop the robots and go, you know, not, I'm not arguing for a Luddite movement, I'm arguing for the exact opposite, which is to say, if that's happening, good for all of us, let's go and figure out what the right set of policies is that can allow us to live in that world.
my tragedy like a miserere meant for only me, while I linger weary 'neath the willow tree. Right here our romance was started, here again we parted when I set you free. All my thoughts are jumbled, everything is blurred, all the world has crumbled, shattered by a word. The end has come, my heart is numb. 'Twas like a bolt from the blue above. I can't believe it, but you're gone, darling, and here lies love. The sky is dark, I hear a lark, he sounds as sad as a mournful dove. The dew appears like the tears of dawn, darling, for here lies love. All my dreams lost beyond recall, dreams of spring blasted into fall. Dry. There's only one thing I'm conscious of. I only know I can't go on, darling, and here lies love. My eyes are dry. There's only one thing I'm conscious of.